This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, it struck me that over Thanksgiving weekend that we have much to be thankful for when it comes to improvements in the healthcare system. And in spite of some of the challenges surrounding the launch of the Affordable Care Act, there were really some great advancements.
We need to look at what the ACA did to help slow down the momentum of cost increases in healthcare in the country. Over the last 8 years, overall healthcare spending grew only 0.8 percentage point. And we can compare that to before the Affordable Care Act, when the healthcare share of GDP rose 3.3 percentage points between 2001 and 2009. That's a pretty significant slowdown. And it's, of course, it's not just all about the dollars. There's been some tremendous outcomes from having so many more people insured.
And analysts say that the slowdown allowed the economy to add more jobs after 2009. 11.9 million jobs were added over the past 7 years. And healthcare hiring rose dramatically in recent years, and healthcare industry wages rose significantly, more than 20%, compared to chronically stagnant wage growth in all other sectors.
We've also seen remarkable advances in health information technology sectors and in adoption of health information technology. We've seen more transparency in health pricing and some improvements on patient safety metrics. The nation's uninsured rate is at its lowest level ever, and that just translates into millions of people with access to health care for prevention, but also for chronic illness management and for acute and life-threatening illnesses.
And the president-elect and President Obama have been having lots of conversations, and President-elect Trump has indicated that there were elements of the Affordable Care Act that really make sense, recognizing that this is an important program and one that need to be improved.
And, you know, over the past year, there's been one big health problem that I think we've heard governors all across the country talk about, as well as people in healthcare, public health, and law enforcement. And that's the opioid crisis in this country and the dramatic rise in deaths due to opioid overdose in the country. And our guest today is a leading expert on this topic.
Dr. Anna Lemke is chief of addiction medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine. Her recently published book, Drug Dealer MD, examines how the dramatic increase in prescriptions for opioids has had a direct impact in the rise of narcotic addiction, overdose, and deaths in this country. And she examines how we should be rethinking our entire approach to the treatment of addiction.
Well, Lori Robertson will also check in, the managing editor from factcheck.org. She is always on the hunt for misstatements that have been spoken about health policy in the public domain.
But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com. If you have any comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. Anna Lemke in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Depression is a growing problem among America's teens, especially adolescent girls. According to statistics compiled by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, more teens say they have suffered from serious depression, but it doesn't mean more are being treated for it. Researchers at Johns Hopkins looked at statistics for about 180,000 American adolescents and found 1 in 11 had some kind of major depressive episode in a given year, with that number increasing dramatically from the early 2000s. Suicide is also on the rise, now a more significant cause of death among middle schoolers than car accidents. The causes are varied. There's been a dramatic rise in incidents of cyberbullying and growing concern that some antidepressants might actually increase suicidal tendencies in some teens. The CDC urges clinicians to become more actively engaged in the primary care setting for screening for depression among the youth and adolescent population. While several more states have approved the decriminalization of marijuana, medical marijuana delivery systems still run the gamut. The pharmaceutical company Teva rolling out an inhaler for testing in Israel that dispenses marijuana vapors for pain management through an inhaler. Inhalation is still determined to be the most effective form of drug delivery for cannabis treatment. Global health leaders are asking G7 leaders to back the creation of a specialist rapid response unit to tackle outbreaks of infectious killer diseases. The move reflects how the World Health Organization, in particular, was caught unprepared last year by Ebola, which spread through three West African countries and killed more than 11,000 people. And it won't be stamped out before the end of the year. Specialist rapid response units would be pre-funded and ready to tackle any breaking health crisis anywhere in the world. Happy daddies, more happily adjusted kids with fewer behavioral issues. That according to a study published in the British journal BMJ Open. They found that children whose dads were emotionally involved and secure in their place in the household at infancy were less likely to develop behavioral problems as adolescents. The study found a father's emotional response to his child as an infant and his security in his role in the household had a significant effect on the later development of behavioral problems in children at both age 9 and age 11. The study concluded it wasn't so much how the dads parented that was significant, but how comfortable they were in the role of dad that made the difference. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Anna Lemke, Chief of Addiction Medicine and Assistant Professor at Stanford University School of Medicine. She's Program Manager for the Addiction Medicine Fellowship with a primary research focus on why patients become addicted to prescription drugs. Dr. Lemke has published over 50 peer-reviewed articles in publications such as the New England Journal of Medicine and the Journal of the American Medical Association. She is the author of Drug Dealer MD, How Doctors Were Duped, Patients Got Hooked, and Why It's So Hard to Stop. Dr. Lemke is a diplomat of both the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology and the American Board of Addiction Medicine. She earned her undergrad degree at Yale and her medical degree from Stanford University School of Medicine. Dr. Lemke, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, as you so clearly articulated, we're in this midst of a devastating public health crisis in the country. Some 50,000 people a year are dying from overdoses, which is sort of reminds me back to the days of the Vietnam War. Your book, Drug Dealer MD, takes an unflinching look at what you see as one of the critical components of the epidemic, the dramatic rise in the number of prescription clinicians have written for opioids in recent years. And as a renowned expert in addiction medicine, I'm wondering if you could help our listeners understand the scope of America's addiction crisis and the correlation between the rise in opioid prescribing and the deadly epidemic.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad you referenced the Vietnam era because that was the opioid epidemic just prior to this one, and this one certainly surpasses that in scope and devastation. Drug overdoses today are the leading cause of accidental death in this country, surpassing deaths due to motor vehicle accidents for the first time in our history. And of the 50,000 annual drug-related deaths, about half of those involved some kind of prescription drug. There's been a quadrupling of the number of deaths since 1999, and along with that, a quadrupling in the number of prescriptions doctors have written for opioid painkillers, although there's been no increase in the need for analgesia or pain relief in that time. So what we have here is really a very clear epidemic of overprescribing in addition to an epidemic of overdose deaths. Just to give people perspective on this, is that the U.S. consumes about 90% of the world's prescription opioids while constituting only about 4% of the world's population.
Amazing.
Well, Dr. Lemke, I think it's important for our listeners to maybe start a little bit at the beginning of what we now understand about addiction, from thinking of this as a moral failure or understanding just how complex the medical, behavioral, and psychiatric underpinnings are. Maybe you could help us understand from your great expertise in this area, what's the description of addiction, the diagnostic description, if you will, and what does this mean within the larger context of healthcare and how we address it?
Probably the best way to describe the disease of addiction is to tell you an anecdote about a patient of mine who called me in desperation one day and said, you know, Dr. Lemke, I'm surrounded by empty vodka bottles. I cannot stop drinking. Can you help me? So this is very powerful, right? This is somebody who fully recognized that she had the disease of addiction to alcohol. She wanted to stop. She clearly could describe her situation, but she was unable to stop drinking without help. Now, the really sad denouement of this story is that in order to get her help, I had to tell her to go to her nearest emergency room and tell them that she was suicidal. And she said, but Dr. Lemke, I'm not suicidal. That's why I'm calling you. I want to live. I just can't stop drinking. And I said to her, I know that, but if you go to the emergency room and tell them that you want to be admitted for alcohol detox, they won't admit you because insurance companies don't pay for that. So you have to tell them that you're suicidal, and then they'll admit you, and then they'll treat your alcohol detox. So what we have here is a very clear scenario of a huge, huge medical condition, public health problem, devastating illness, and yet we don't have a way to get people ready access and ready treatment paid for by their insurance company. So instead, what are we doing? We're spending $400+ billion per year paying for the downstream effects of addiction.
You know, I was trying to think through the political strategy, if you will, which is manifest in the laws that states and the federal government pass over the last 40 or 50 years. And certainly there were stiff marijuana laws evolved in the 70s, and later there were tough laws related to the crack epidemic. In your book, Drug Dealer MD, you focus on what you call prescription drugs as the new gateway drugs. And I'm wondering what role the pharmaceutical industry has played in this latest chapter of the drug addiction scenario, and well-meaning doctors were duped into complicity.
Right. So my title, Drug Dealer MD, is, you know, intentionally provocative, but also a little bit misleading, because I really do feel that this epidemic is driven primarily not by pill mill doctors exchanging prescriptions for cash, but by well-intentioned, compassionate doctors. And the way that doctors were really duped is that they were misled to believe that the evidence supported the use of opioids in the treatment of chronic pain. Now, we now know that there is essentially no evidence that opioids, when prescribed long-term, helps chronic pain. The reason for that is because people develop tolerance through the process called neuroadaptation, and the opioids just simply don't work anymore. So what happened in the 1980s is some thought leaders within medicine suggested that we should more liberally prescribe opioids. So the important point here is, out of good intentions came a bad idea to use opioids more freely to treat pain. It was essentially the pharmaceutical industry, but they didn't use a kind of straightforward approach. What they did was more like a Trojan horse approach, and they infiltrated big medicine by making all kinds of partnerships with the Joint Commission, with the FDA, with the Federation of State Medical Boards, funneling money into these organizations, into pain societies, that opioids work long-term for pain, even though there was really scant evidence. I do feel that doctors were duped, because in this era of so-called evidence-based medicine, there's enormous pressure on doctors to practice medicine supported by the evidence, and they were told that the evidence supported using opioids chronically for pain, even though that wasn't true. So it got to be a kind of a groupthink. And then, of course, there were many factors within healthcare delivery that made using opioids to treat complex problems like pain an easy solution.
I appreciate that you acknowledge the clinicians are motivated to do right by their patients, but there's this conundrum, a dramatic lack of training in this area of understanding and assessing and diagnosing and managing and treating chronic pain. What are we going to do about this to help both clinicians and consumers move forward to get a better handle on how we manage chronic pain going forward?
I do feel positive that we're about to, you know, make a big shift in medical school education. I was recently part of a White House symposium in October in Washington, D.C. A lot of educators from around the country, deans of medical schools, coming together and talking about how we can revamp the medical school curriculum to better address the issue of addiction. But you're absolutely right. You know, we currently have a terrible situation in which physicians learn almost nothing in most medical schools on how to target and treat addiction, and much of their pain education emphasizes getting patients on opioids. And let me tell you, it's a lot easier to get them on than to get off. And if we don't tackle this public health crisis, then we're really going to just perpetuate this problem. Although I will say that I don't think education alone is going to be enough. Mm-hmm. We really have to restructure some of the incentives within the healthcare delivery system.
We're speaking today with Dr. Anna Lemke, Chief of Addiction Medicine and Assistant Professor at Stanford University School of Medicine. She's author of drug dealer, MD. Dr. Lemke, I want to pull the thread a little on this notion of solutions. And, you know, Margaret said that we want to do the right thing, but we have the wrong tools. And one of the things that we do at our Weitzman Institute is that we have a nationwide pain echo. And this is sort of video physicians and nurse practitioners, other providers are able to present cases to addiction experts, psychiatry, nursing, orthopedic surgeons, and along with acupuncture and the like. What other tools are you seeing out there that the practicing provider might be able to use because they just don't have the right tools?
Well, I think that fortunately there's tremendous outreach now. The ECHO program is a great example of how to tap into addiction experts in order to learn how to handle these complex patients. There's a push in some states to get doctors to register and even access their prescription drug monitoring program, which is a good first step in screening doctors to determine, you know, whether or not somebody is doctor shopping, going to multiple prescribers, or maybe combining opioids and benzodiazepines, which has an increased risk of overdose deaths. So I think there, you know, there are a lot of opportunities out there. What, again, what concerns me, though, is beyond education, and I think education is important, we need to actually make it economically feasible and rewarding for healthcare systems and individual doctors to pursue these efforts. So you talk about how you in your organization have a team-based approach. You've got the, you know, the orthopedic surgeon with the psychiatrist and the social worker and the primary care doctor. Fantastic. But I would ask you, do you get reimbursed for that time?
No.
Right. You don't. So, you know, it's out of the goodness of your heart and because you care about patients and you're aware of the public health crisis, and that's fantastic. But we really need to restructure the reimbursement strategy so that we incentivize doctors to do the right thing. Because otherwise, you know, you're going to get pockets of doing the right thing, but you're not going to get systemic reform.
Dr. Lemke, it's really just within the last decade that those of us on the front lines of primary care have been asked to play an active role in the treatment of drug dependency. But we've really been asked to take on the responsibility of treating drug dependency, and particularly medication-assisted treatment, Suboxone being the most common one. Talk about the use of medical interventions for addiction management, if you will. And then also, what's the need for better use of other integrative or alternative therapies to treat this population? The individual counseling or the group counseling support for folks, maybe you could comment on that.
Yes, I think it's fascinating that primary care doctors are expected to solve this problem, like as if they didn't have enough to do already. We'll let the, you know, the orthopedic surgeons and whoever else get people addicted, and then you guys get to, you know, sort of pick up the pieces. That's really interesting. All right, so let's talk about Suboxone for a second. I have also seen life-changing success with Suboxone, and the evidence is overwhelming that it's very effective, not just to reduce the use of illicit opioids among people who are addicted to opioids, but it also decreases crime. However, I am very concerned that this is kind of a typical knee-jerk reaction to the problem of addiction, yet one more pill that we're prescribing. And although Suboxone is effective, I don't think it's as effective as it could be if it were combined with psychosocial interventions, then really it should be combined with psychosocial interventions. And I'd really like to see a lot more, again, reimbursement, effort, money, teaching behind psychosocial interventions, not just kind of a one-size-fits-all slap on some Suboxone. There are lots of different interventions that work for the treatment of addiction. You know, the individual therapy, group therapy, family therapy. There are other medications besides Suboxone for opioid addiction, namely something called naltrexone, which blocks the mu opioid receptor. And so it can also, in those individuals, they report actual decreased cravings. So that's a fascinating phenomenon. How does that work? And then there are also a lot of community-level interventions that are very helpful.
You know, you have the pharmaceutical industry, which is out there developing and promoting life-saving drugs. And you have the FDA, which is empowered to really review drugs to improve the public health of the population and protecting consumers. And something went wrong here. What would you say are the strengths and weaknesses in that relationship between the FDA and the pharmaceutical industry? And what could be a better process for ensuring that we don't end up with a new round that created another set of problems for us.
So the FDA was essentially asleep at the wheel while the prescription opioid crisis was unfolding. Even as people were dying of prescription opioid overdoses, they were doing very little to prevent pharma from misbranding opioids as non-addictive. And really, in addition to approving new drugs, is to police these drugs after they're out there and make sure there aren't new adverse consequences that come up. And they really didn't do this. Even as, for example, Purdue Pharma, the makers of OxyContin, were advertising that less than 1% of patients would get addicted. They were putting this, on their advertisements.
I remember that.
The FDA did nothing about it. The other thing about the FDA is they have a very compromised relationship with pharmacy, in which the pharmaceutical industry advises them on how to devise their studies to approve opioids. So in the 1990s, the FDA changed their approval process for new opioids to a study design called enriched enrollment. Essentially, it's a way of cheating and making it easier for new opioids to get approved. And they did this, in collusion at large meetings with academic thought leaders funded by Big Pharma. So they rescheduled hydrocodone products to Schedule II to make it harder for doctors to prescribe them. That was a step forward. But essentially, in 2013, they approved Zohydro, which is a long-acting formulation of hydrocodone, sort of akin to OxyContin, which is crazy. The other thing I really want people to be very aware of is the FDA is now strongly promoting what they call abuse-deterrent alternatives of opioids. So What does this mean? Formulations of opioids that are hard to crush and snort, or crush and inject. However, there's no evidence that abuse-deterrent formulations, in fact, mitigate the risk of addiction because the most common way to misuse opioids is to just ingest them as you normally would,
right?
An example of a recent abuse-deterrent formulation, Opana, released in 2011, was supposedly an abuse-deterrent formulation of an opioid, and it was at the center of the HIV epidemic in Indiana. So I'm very concerned that the FDA keeps churning out new opioids. We don't need any more new opioids. So what? How can we solve this problem? There really needs to be separation of church and state. The FDA and the pharmaceutical industry should not be cooperating on the level that they're cooperating. The FDA has to do a better job policing. They shouldn't be approving more opioids. We have enough.
Well, Dr. Lemke, let me just ask you one last question, if you will. This might be an area in which there's actually bipartisan agreement across the country and in Washington about it being such an urgent problem that needs to be addressed. I'm sure you've been very engaged in following policies that have been discussed. What should we and our listeners look forward to possibly seeing in the coming weeks or months in terms of new funding or legislative or policy changes to increase access to treatment for this problem and to reduce the risk of further problems down the road?
Well, as you know, Obama pledged $1.1 billion to try to fight opioid addiction. So hopefully, those funds will happen to increase access. A lot of that has gone into increasing access to Suboxone prescribing, which is great because, as I said before, it works. But I would love to see some of those monies go toward psychosocial interventions and actually paying doctors to spend time with their patients, helping their patients get off of opioids, which is a long-term and laborious process, as well as providing non-opioid alternatives to pain, from psychotherapy to acupuncture to trigger point massage, whatever it is, to providing non-opioid alternatives to addiction. And I also hope that there will be more widespread recognition of the fact that, if you're going to ask primary care doctors to take care of not just diabetes, hypertension, and heart disease, but also addiction, homelessness, and unemployment, that you give them the resources to do that.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Anna Lemke, Chief of Addiction Medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine and author of Drug Dealer MD, How Doctors Were Duped, Patients Got Hooked, and Why It's So Hard to Stop. You can learn more about her work by going to med.stanford.edu/profiles/Anna-Lemke, or you can follow her on Twitter at Stanford Med or at Drug Dealer MD. Dr. Lemke, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you for having me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Recently, House Speaker Paul Ryan mentioned the Independent Payment Advisory Board created by the Affordable Care Act, saying it was, quote, about to kick in with price controls on Medicare. We haven't heard much about this board since the first year or two after the law was passed. So what has happened with the Independent Payment Advisory Board? Well, this 15-member independent board, which would be appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate, is tasked with making recommendations on how Medicare can cut costs. It would make binding recommendations if Medicare spending exceeded certain levels. But no one has yet been appointed to this board, which is to consist of medical professionals, economists, healthcare experts, and consumer representatives, and its actions haven't been triggered due to slow growth in per-enrollee healthcare spending. As the nonpartisan Kaiser Family Foundation explains in a July 2016 report, the IPAB process is set to be triggered for the first time next year, based on the Medicare actuary's most recent spending projection. Without a board in place, the Secretary of Health and Human Services would be tasked with making the recommendations for spending growth reductions to start in 2019. Under the ACA, the recommendations could be replaced by other measures passed by Congress to reduce spending or overridden altogether, but that would require a 3/5 majority in each House. The board is limited in what it can do. It can't raise taxes, premiums, or cost sharing, or otherwise ration care. According to an analysis by the Kaiser Family Foundation, any recommended reductions would come from, quote, Medicare Advantage, the Part D prescription drug program, skilled nursing facility, home health, and durable medical equipment. With the new administration coming into office in January, however, it's unclear what would happen to these provisions of the Affordable Care Act. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. If music soothes the savage beast, as the saying goes, the question they want to answer at the SYNC Project is, how exactly? There are lots of anecdotal studies supporting music's ability to trigger memory or boost endurance or focus, but virtually nothing is known about how music truly impacts our physiological and neurological state. This is the question that intrigued scientist Keiki Kuranam, a systems biology PhD from Harvard, along with two other co-founders from MIT, who wondered, how could music be scientifically harnessed as a powerful precision medicine tool? They formed the SYNC Project with a cross-section of neuroscientists, biologists, audio engineers, even some rock stars like Peter Gabriel, and started by using artificial intelligence systems to analyze existing playlists that purport to promote relaxation, induce sleep, enhance focus, or athletic performance.
And once we have this set of songs that our machine learning algorithms predict to be effective for a specific activity, we can then run studies using these devices like your heart rate monitors, your smartwatches, your activity trackers, and actually look at how effective indeed is that song for that purpose. And data feeds back into the recommendation engines and only helps us improve these models.
Kuranam and her colleagues note that most of us self-medicate with music already, so why not harness this ubiquitous tool that's available to all of us and develop strategies and systems that might replace pharmacological interventions with musical ones? The SYNC Project is seeking 1 million volunteers to offer their music suggestions, as well as any information they can share on why these songs seem to work for them.
So we're literally walking around with, 14 million songs in our pocket every single day. So we saw a great opportunity in putting these two together and really being able to understand how music was affecting us, to be able to measure how different types of music affect both our psychological health as well as our physiology.
Karanam and her team see vast potential for reducing reliance on drugs by crafting personalized music interventions in the management of a variety of complex conditions, such as pain management, PTSD, even movement disorders like Parkinson's disease.
One of the areas we are interested in is movement disorders and learning how specific properties of the music affects a person's ability to regulate gait. In Parkinson's disease, patients have trouble initiating movement or coordinating movement. So by playing them the right kind of music, it can be an external auditory support they have that's going to help them walk more smoothly.
The SYNC Project, combining computer technology and neuroscience, physiology, and musicology to harness the healing powers inherent in music, creating non-pharmacologic therapies to help manage a variety of human ills, now that is a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.